Lorraine Hansberry would often be described as a sort of ingenue, meaning a naive young woman. This happened because most of the media didn't know how to pin her down, didn't know exactly what she was. She had strong opinions and was very vocal about them, and the fact that she had grace and beauty only added to the confusion. Because of this, it seemed like everyone had an opinion of her, including the FBI, who saw her as somewhat of a threat on account of her writing. And 1 year before her breakthrough stage play was written in 1956, the FBI described her as such, 5'4" tall, 105 to 110 pounds, Negro, Italian haircut, no glasses, light brown, yellow shirt, and black toreadors. Now, if she ever actually got around to reading the description, I can imagine it fazed her as she was hardened by the experiences that had led up to and inspired her most famous writing. The title for this play was taken from the Langston Hughes poem, Harlem. In the poem, Hughes reflects on what happens to deferred dreams, the consequences of which could end up in explosive outbursts or leave defeated people clinging to the last remnants of hope drying up. Welcome to House of Words, a podcast about writers, stage plays, and change. I am your host, Jason Nemoor Harden, inviting you to join us as we explore Lorraine Hansberry's play, A Raisin in the Sun. It is about time that equipped women began to take on some of the ethical questions which a male-dominated culture has produced and dissect and analyze them quite to pieces in a serious fashion. It is time that half the human race had something to say about the nature of its existence. End quote. She was born on May 19, 1930, which was a cool day in the windy city of Chicago, Illinois. It seems quite fitting that she was born in Provident, the first hospital both owned and operated by Black Americans in the U.S. at that time, given that she too would change Black American history. Her parents, like thousands of Black Americans during the early 1900s, had escaped the Deep South in search of greener pastures. In their case, they settled on Chicago. Now, born a year before the nadir of the Great Depression, Lorraine would spend most of her life trying to make sense of the troubling eras that would follow. From World War II to McCarthyism and civil rights, she was placed at the perfect time to make explosive art. But that would come later. Now, as a child of the Black middle class, she felt isolated from her peers, though she would, like most children in her neighborhood, attend Jim Crow schools on the south side of Chicago. The school days would be half a day long and would, in Hansberry's adult years, not count as proof of valid school attendance. Now, it wasn't that her parents couldn't afford to send her to private school. Quite on the contrary, they had the means to do so, but according to Lorraine, her parents simply didn't believe in private school. When she was 8 years old, she attended her third grade school, A.O. Sexton, which was located in a white neighborhood, the same neighborhood where her father, Carl Hansberry, decided to buy a house. Her father was a revolutionary and would therefore spend much of his time traveling, arguing for various causes. Her mother, on the other hand, would spend her time in the house with the children. And one day, while Lorraine was on the porch of the house with her sister, minding their own business, swinging their legs, a mob gathered close by. The mob began approaching them. This naturally caused the Hansberry sisters to seek refuge inside the house. And while they were in the living room, hoping that the mob would just leave, a brick flew in through the window with such force that it embedded itself in the opposite wall. The brick just barely missed Lorraine's head. Well, the family decided to move after just 8 months in that house. Lorraine had a troubled relationship with her parents growing up. From her perspective, they approached parenting in a very cold and peculiar manner. While all four of the Hansberry children were fed, clothed, and provided for, there was little to no intimacy or coddling. When they got sick, they were nursed back to health with the appropriate remedies and attention, but with minimal affection. This encouraged young Lorraine to rebel. She resented their emotional distance. Then there were their lessons about race and racial loyalty. This seemed like another threshold for her to cross, in particular, how one must never betray the race. While rebellion grew in her teenage heart, life would soon provide a thunderous blow. Her father, having decided that there was little hope for racial integration in the United States or any chance for a decent life, made a trip to Mexico in hopes of finding a place to move his family. Unfortunately, Carl Hansberry would be stricken by a brain aneurysm that took his life while looking for this hope of a new life. Lorraine would later say in an interview, "He died in 1945 at the age of 51 of a cerebral hemorrhage, supposedly, but American racism helped kill him." Now, the telegram her mother sent to her children from Mexico lacked affection, as was the standard, and it read, "Daddy passed, will be home soon as possible with body. Be brave, Mother." Lorraine was 15 years old at the time. In 1948, she graduated from Inglewood High School. Had she been a conventional young, middle-class black woman, she most likely would have studied at a historical black college or university. But no, Lorraine being Lorraine, she had a thirst to explore uncharted territory. She chose the very large, progressive, and populous University of Wisconsin, where only a very small number of black students had ever enrolled. Her stay at the university, though short, would introduce her to what would become her favorite playwright, Sean O'Casey. It was the second work of his Dublin trilogy, Juno and the Peacock, a tragedy in three parts, that particularly struck a chord with her. In the play, Dublin tenement life during the Irish Civil War is depicted and explored in all its broken glory. Later, she would remember sitting there, consumed as she was guided through the tenement, through Dublin and Ireland itself, through the character O'Casey had so perfectly fleshed out. Dublin and the struggles the people were going through there were an ocean removed from her own experiences and struggles. However, it felt like a familiar one, like a melody she had known a very long time ago and had suddenly been reminded of again. What she was particularly fascinated by when it came to O'Casey was the complexity of his characters. They were not tidy and proper. Some were drunks, some were revolutionaries, some were cowards. He wasn't concerned with making the Irish look good or stay clear of stereotypes. His number one priority was concerned with making them feel real, which was exactly how she wanted to portray her characters. Supposed betrayal of the race be damned. Well, in the summer of 1950, she decided that she was done with her formal education and was ready to get better affiliated with a different corner of knowledge. And so, with the hum of the black movement guiding her, she made the move to New York City. It was 1951 when she arrived in New York, and while Harlem was the place to be, Hansberry didn't begin her New York journey there. Instead, she moved downtown to Greenwich Village. There, she enrolled in courses in jewelry making, photography, short story writing, and the history of American civilization at the New School for Social Research. This move, however, seemed not to be in the cards. Thus, after what she referred to as two erratic months, she dropped out. But she very much liked something about where she was in New York and decided to remain in the village. It seemed like she was finally where she needed to be because that fall she had her first writings published. It was a poem titled "Flag from a Kitchenette Window." The piece appeared in the leftist magazine Masses and Mainstream. The poem reads, "Southside morning, America is crying. In our land, the paycheck taxes to somebody's government. Black boy in a window, Algiers and Salerno. The three colored banner raised to some anonymous freedom. We decide, and on the Memorial Day hang it from our windows and let it beat the steamy Jim Crow airs. She grew more engaged in issues concerning black folks, and towards the end of 1951, she made the move uptown to Harlem. She began to attend tenant strikes and civil rights protests. She took to the microphone and delivered lectures about racial and economic justice at the famous Speaker's Corner at 135th and Lenox. However, the writer of letters to her former college classmate and good friend, Edith, she wrote,
"I am living in New York now, since last November, and I can't remember what I wrote you last or how much I told you when I did write. Probably a lot of nonsense about Greenwich Village and that business. Fact is, I have finally stopped going to school and started working, which means a lot of things. I work for the new Negro paper, Freedom, which in its time in history ought to be the journal of Negro liberation. In fact, it will be."
Of Freedom was the brainchild of leftist actor and singer Paul Robeson. Robeson was the paper's publisher, while the editor of the weekly journal was Louis Burnham, a Harlem native who had been active in the American student movement, as well as the Young Communist League. Burnham welcomed Hansberry into the Freedom office, which overlooked Lenox Avenue. The office was as humble as they come. There were two desks, one typewriter, Louis and Lorraine, and not much else. The resources were obviously limited, but the fire and dedication needed to make a big splash was far from lacking. Lorraine earned $31.70 a week, which, she noted, kept her lean. Though she was somewhat on the low end of food supplies, she was getting a different kind of nourishment, one of the revolutionary sort. Recognizing her talent, Louis Burnham quickly moved her from clerical to editorial and writing work. He became a close mentor of hers and would refer to her as the girl who could do everything. She would learn the ropes as she worked, and she was indeed a hard worker. For Lorraine, black freedom and the prospect of a society free of capitalism were intertwined. This was partially a result of the influence of other mentors, such as Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois, in addition to Louis Burnham, but it was also the result of her studies. She believed that the exploitation of people, labor, and the land by the wealthy, while most of the world suffered, was fundamentally unjust. The only redeeming organization of society, as far as she was concerned, would be one of commonwealth and common good. All of this came through in her writing, which was both political and critical, but not at all creative at that time. Though she didn't write fiction or poems for the journal, Burnham nevertheless encouraged her creativity. What also fueled her creative aspirations was the community of artists in Harlem that used the arts as both a political tool as well as a creative means of expression. During this time, she befriended South Carolinian actress Alice Childress, who, despite being 16 years her senior, shared many ideas with her. Childress was a frequent contributor to Freedom, as well as an actress and playwright, which was just the kind of person Hansberry needed in her life to make the next step possible. Childress brought her into the black theater world of New York, and they began collaborating. In 1952, they wrote a pageant for the Freedom Negro History Festival, which was narrated by Harry Belafonte, playwright Douglas Turner Ward, Sidney Poitier, and novelist John Oliver Killens. It seemed this was the spark she needed, because following this, she dove deep into the world of stage playwriting. As we often mention here at House of Words, the amalgamation of influences and experiences needed to create a masterful piece of writing are most often plentiful, and Lorraine Hansberry is no exception. A major influence came from her father and his passionate pursuit of equality for all people. Carl Hansberry's entrepreneurialism was consistently connected to fighting against Jim Crow practices, and his greatest fight began in 1937, the year Lorraine turned 7 years old. That year, her father directed his attention on a brick building up for purchase at 6140 South Rose Avenue in Chicago, Illinois. What made this purchase very different from his previous purchases was the fact that this building was covered by a racially restrictive covenant, a private land agreement in which neighbors in the area had agreed to not sell to Negroes or anyone else outside the white race. Such agreements were not uncommon in 1937. In fact, these agreements covered the majority of Chicago real estate. However, a personal dispute between one homeowner who served on the board of the Woodlawn Property Owners Association and the rest of the board led him to sabotage the neighborhood by selling his home to a Negro. This Negro was, of course, Carl Hansberry. Carl was well aware that his purchase would lead to a legal battle and was quick to enlist the support of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in advance. Furthermore, he received a mortgage from the Supreme Life and Liberty Insurance Company, a black-owned outfit that was often involved in black politics in the city. Now, the case that formed from Carl Hansberry's bold move is today in constitutional law textbooks. Unfortunately, behind the success that Papa Hansberry accomplished lay a terrible story for 7-year-old Lorraine. As an adult, she would describe the event in an unpublished letter to the New York Times. Her father, she said, spent a great deal of money and time working on the case with the NAACP while she, her mother, and siblings occupied the home, feeling like they were living under siege. Outside their door, a howling white mob lay in wait. She and her siblings were hit, spat upon, and cursed out as they walked to and from school. In the evenings, her mother protected the home with a German Luger pistol. Better not mess with mama's babies. This was the same house mentioned earlier where Lorraine was almost struck by a piece of cement that crashed through the window and embedded itself in the wall before they eventually moved. Anyone familiar with Hansberry's most famous play, A Raisin in the Sun, might connect the dots between what the Hansberry family experienced during that time and the stage play. In the play, the black family buys a home in a white neighborhood in Chicago, and they are treated similarly to how the Hansberry family was treated. But what gave the play a deeper level of realism was how this experience was not unique. There were literally hundreds of cases like this across the Midwest. Black families moving into quote-unquote white neighborhoods and having to deal with mob violence in response to their efforts to integrate. The consequences were destroyed property, lost homes, trauma, and sometimes death. Unlike the South, where the racial structure was predicted in other and much more sinister manners, such as segregated train cars and public toilets, all the way to lynchings, in the northern cities, real estate was where inequality was at the forefront. Written between her 26th and 27th birthday, thus cementing it between 1956 and 1957, it took her a total of 8 months to complete A Raisin in the Sun. Later, looking back on the process, she remembers that she was writing about 3 plays at the time, one of which happened to be the play that would change everything for her, as well as American literature. Now, the story goes that one evening in the summer of 1957, she shared a draft of the manuscript with her friend and theatrical producer, Philip Rose. She and her husband, Robert Nemiroff, hosted Rose in their apartment at 337 Bleecker Street. A little background about the couple. They were married in 1953. Robert Nemiroff was actually the reason that she had been able to pursue writing full-time after earning his fair share for co-writing the hit song, Cindy, Oh Cindy. Though they were divorced the same year that A Raisin in the Sun was written, the two would continue to have a professional relationship until Hansberry's death. Now, back to that meeting with Rose. Hansberry fed Philip Rose spaghetti for dinner and followed it with banana cream pie for dessert. Then the couple read him the draft of the play. Rose was immediately captivated by what they read to him. The trio wound up talking far into the night, rolling on into the following morning. Back home, after the long night, Rose gave Lorraine a call and told her that he wanted to get the play up on the stage and on Broadway. It would take Rose 15 months to raise the money to put A Raisin in the Sun on Broadway, as even those who were sympathetic to his enthusiasm didn't believe that a play featuring black people emoting would draw crowds. Well, after scrambling together resources for more than a year, that theory would be put to the test. The cast and crew for the piece held trial runs in Philadelphia and New Haven, which were traditional places to test a production's future prospects on Broadway. It was a great success in both cities. They held an additional trial run in Chicago, which caused Hansberry a great deal of anxiety, but that was the one that sealed the deal. The play's extraordinary cast, including the already established Sidney Poitier and a brilliant though untested young black director, Lloyd Richards, gave Hansberry's words the depth and intensity needed. With stamps of approval from both critics and audiences alike, A Raisin in the Sun made it to Broadway on March 11, 1959. Broadway audiences had never seen the work of a black playwright and director featuring a black cast with no singing, no dancing, and no slapstick, but instead with a clear social message. Here was a family living in the South Side Chicago ghetto armed with a $10,000 life insurance check after the death of the father. Their hope was to move out of their tiny kitchenette apartment and into a house in a segregated white neighborhood. The adult son, Walter Lee, dreams of becoming a businessman. His sister, Benita, aspires to become a doctor. The matriarch, Lena, and her daughter-in-law are most of all hoping for a home of their own. Despite the early misgivings of financiers and skepticism from many, A Raisin in the Sun played at the Ethel Barrymore Theater for 19 months before transferring to the Belasco Theater for another 8. It was a tremendous success. Lorraine Hansberry, though unwaveringly a member of the far left, had written a play that wasn't overtly political, didactic, or heavy-handed. She had chosen, like Sean O'Casey, to write characters who were true, who were oppressed, who sought freedom, and who were also shaped by the society in which they lived, but not turning away from any aspect with the thought of staying loyal to her race. She would later say that despite being very well received by both audience and critics, she did not feel that the play was a success because everybody associated with it was black. She was proud of the fact that they went to great pains to get the best director and the best actors for the play, and went on to say that she wrote the play out of a specific intellectual point of view opposed to a political stance. As with O'Casey, she reasoned that the real drama on stage works so well because it has to do with audience involvement and with achieving the emotional transformation of people on the stage. She would say, and I quote,
"I believe that ideas can be transmitted emotionally."
The play had been a long time in the making. From her first publication, Flag from a Kitchenette Window, she'd shown signs that she, like her father, wanted to take a stance. Through her years as an up-and-coming writer, she continuously rewrote versions of her childhood encounters with white mob violence when they moved out of the boundaries of the ghetto. Her struggles were real and still fresh in her mind, which is why the play felt real and resonated with so many. She was only 28 years old, yet already had an imposing presence and powerful intellect that the theater world was forced to reckon with. Sadly and unfortunately, the story of Lorraine Hansberry would be cut short as a mere 6 years later, she would die of pancreatic cancer on January 12, 1965, at the age of 34. In his introduction to Hansberry's posthumously released autobiography, To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, an informal autobiography, the legendary writer James Baldwin wrote that,
"It is not at all far-fetched to suspect that what she saw contributed to the strain which killed her, for the effort to which Lorraine was dedicated is more than enough to kill a man."
Hansberry's funeral was held in Harlem 3 days after her passing. Paul Robeson and SNCC organizer James Foreman gave eulogies. The presiding minister read a message from the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., which read, "Her creative ability and her profound grasp of the deep social issues confronting the world today will remain an inspiration to generations yet unborn." Right on, Doc. Now let us end this episode with a quote from the writer who refused to let her dreams dry up and instead made them bleed on paper.
"There is always something left to love, and if you ain't learned that, you ain't learned nothing."
End quote. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode and will spread the word about the podcast. Once again, I have been your host, Jason Nemore Harden. We here at House of Words ask that you please consider helping to make this show easier to produce and more frequent by contributing on our Patreon page at patreon.com/houseofwords or paypal.me/houseofwordspodcast. Alternatively, you can subscribe and encourage others to subscribe to our YouTube page, House of Words Podcast. Every little bit helps, more than you might think. Until next time, keep turning those pages. House of Words is written and produced by Crystal M. Sanchez. Narrated and written by me, Jason Nemore Harden, and music by Creature 9 and Wood. All rights and ownership belong to Crystal M. Sanchez and Jason Nemore Harden.